Well, tonight on Coast to Coast, we have two very important researchers for you. Robert Bovall, he's been on the program before, and Dr. Thomas Brophy. They have teamed together to write Black Genesis, the prehistoric African origins of ancient Egypt. And there's so much to talk about. They're both very accomplished researchers. And we'll be back with both Robert Bovall and Dr. Thomas Brophy in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, a couple of guests for you this hour, and next, and the next after, Robert Bovall, born in Egypt in 1948. In 1989, he published a study which proposed that the layout of the three Giza pyramids and their relative position to the Nile was intended to mirror the layout of the three stars in the Orion's belt, and that their relative position to the Milky Way. This thesis is now known as the Orion Correlation Theory, and also Dr. Thomas Brophy with us tonight. Dr. Thomas Brophy is an astrophysicist who worked with NASA, including as a member of the Voyager 2 spacecraft instrument teams. He's the author of several books and numerous published articles in scientific journals. Here's Dr. Thomas Brophy as well. Robert, welcome to the show again.
Yeah, hi, George. It's nice to be on your show again.
Good to have you with us, and Dr. Thomas Brophy is with us. Hello, doctor.
Hi, George. Nice to be on with you.
Looking forward to this. Robert, for those who don't have the benefit of knowing who you are. You've been on many times, but new listeners, tell us a little bit about Robert Bovall.
Well, Robert Bovall at the moment is in southern Spain. It's about 8 o'clock in the morning here. As you rightly said, I was born in Egypt in 1948, and I left Egypt in 67 to go and settle in England, where I completed my studies and graduated as a construction engineer. I went working for quite a few years in the Middle East and Africa. And to cut a long story short, in 1984, I came up with what you mentioned in the introduction. I came up with the Orion Correlation Theory, which was eventually published in a book form in 1994. Since then, I've pursued the same line of study. I've written seven books on the topic, on ancient Egypt. And now I've teamed up with my very good friend and colleague, Dr. Thomas Brophy, and we've come up with Black Genesis.
And tell me how this relationship with an astrophysicist got underway.
That's very interesting, because as you probably know, George, I'm one of the bad boys of the academic circle with the Orion Correlation Theory, which has kind of shaken up the Egyptological and archaeological world. Tom and I met, let me get this right, Tom, it was 2003, I think so,
yeah,
in San Diego. We got together because, in fact, Tom was the first academic and scientist who got interested in the Orion Correlation Theory, and he will tell you his own story in a minute, of course.
Right.
And it was kind of interesting for the, in a sense, for the opposing team to get together. As you know, myself and Graham Hancock and John West and Robert Schock formed a kind of horsemen of the apocalypse for the academics for a while. And it was very interesting to see what a scientist like Tom felt about all this. And we hit it immediately. I mean, and we realized that we were studying the same topic, which, again, Tom will elaborate on this. We were both looking at the Napta Playa mystery, these ancient megalithic stones that we found in the Sahara. And one thing led to another, and we decided we'll research together and come up with this book.
Okay, let's go to you, Dr. Brophy. Tell us a little bit about your background and your relationship with Robert.
Okay, sure. Well, right now I'm here in San Diego, California, and I did my PhD work at the University of Colorado in planetary astrophysics, as you mentioned, working with spacecraft data of the planets and interpreting them and doing dynamical modeling and celestial mechanics-related calculations. And through a sort of circuitous loop, that's what brought me back to, or onward to this archaeoastronomy that I'm collaborating with Robert on now. And that path also took me through moving my focus from planetary astrophysics and physics that my degree was in, more into what you might call integral philosophy or integral developmental theory. And I moved to a sort of experimental small graduate school that I was administering here in California, and also wrote my first book titled The Mechanism Demands of Mysticism on this topic of how modern physics might be reopened to the sort of ancient spiritual view of the spiritual tradition view of the world. And in that process, a later research topic came up for me, research project. I decided to test Robert's Orion correlation theory because I had sort of the mathematical tools to do the calculations myself. And also, from my experience in academic science and, you know, publishing peer-reviewed articles and being a peer-review referee myself sometimes, I had experienced that in all areas of science, there can tend to be this sort of gang mentality where you have a mindset around some a little theory or that's supposed to be the standard model, and it's really hard to change or to even get a word in that's kind of beyond the mindset. So I had sympathy towards the struggles Robert was having, sort of natural sympathy in that direction.
And they were dramatic. And by the way, I've got to ask you, Tom, about today's planetary discovery of 5 to 7 planets in a solar system and the sun and everything else. That's pretty dramatic, isn't it, for an astrophysicist? That's exciting.
I heard about that. It sounds fantastic. Yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing the details. I think there's a press conference later this week.
There's a press conference on Thursday. May not be related to this discovery, so we'll find out. Robert, in your first book, The Orion Mystery, which came out in 1994, let's talk a little bit about the specifics of what you went through that came up with that theory that, you know what, these pyramids are laid out like the stars in Orion's belt. How'd that all happen?
I'll be brief because it's a long story. But I was working at the time in 1983. I was working in Saudi Arabia. And I took a trip to Egypt to visit my family. My mother was still living there. And while I was in Cairo on my way to Alexandria, I went to the Cairo Museum, and as fate would have it, I was carrying a camera with me. In those days, you could take pictures inside the museum, not so these days.
Yeah, they've locked that out now, haven't they?
Yeah, it's our good friend, Dr. Hawass. We'll talk about him later, George.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, there was I in the museum with my Olympus OM-1 camera, for those interested. And I went in a room where they had the artifacts of the pyramid builders. And on the wall was a photograph, an aerial photograph, of the Giza Necropolis, of the pyramids of Giza. It was a direct overhead picture. And it was the first time I ever saw an overhead picture. I must say, in 1983, the world was very different. We didn't have Google Earth and satellite photography and so forth. It was not so common to see this kind of aerial photography. And it was the first time that it struck me, surprisingly, because I had seen maps of the pyramids before, but seeing them on a photograph, it struck me that I was looking at what was clearly a plan. There are three pyramids, two of almost equal size, the Great Pyramid and the Second Pyramid. And the Third Pyramid, the smallest, was offset from a diagonal that passed through the first, the two largest. It was offset to the left or the east. And it's one of those things, you know, I always describe it as, I don't know if you have this experience, George, by being in a dinner party and sitting at the table, and across the room there's a painting on the wall that is skew width. and this, yeah, this terrible urge to sort of stand up and put it straight.
Time, Robert, all the time.
Well, it's a kind of thing we all have. We want to see things in straight lines and neat. In any case, there it was, this offset kind of stuck in my mind. It just didn't make sense. And I snapped a photograph with my camera and went back to Saudi Arabia where I was working. And there I invited a group of friends to look at this photograph. Now, I was working in the construction field, so there was many specialists, architects, engineers, surveyors, technicians. And all of them looked at this photograph and were all convinced, like I was, that there was a plan. The only thing they couldn't understand is, what did it mean? Why was the third pyramid smaller and offset? And with that kind of almost obsessive thought in my mind, I was camping in the desert. Now, I had, again by fluke, brought with me from Egypt a kind of coffee table book with lovely pictures of the pyramids and so forth. And there was a photograph of the so-called pyramid texts. I'll talk about these later as we go along.
Sure.
And there was a passage from these pyramid texts that mentioned that the king, after his death, would travel to the stars and join the god Osiris in the constellation of Orion. Now, with these thoughts stuck in my mind, there am I in the desert at night with a friend of mine who happened to be a navigator, and he pointed at the constellation, which is one of those things, you know. I hadn't bothered to look at the constellation, and there it was in the sky, nice and bright. It's very bright, by the way, in the morning now at this time of year. And he pointed at the three stars of Orion's belt and said, here are the stars of Orion's belt, and we use them for navigation because they rise due east,
uh-huh,
as you can see, they're in a row. And then in an afterthought, he said, well, the little one at the top is offset to the left. And the penny dropped in my mind. I mean, it was one of those moments, you know, sort of eureka moments.
Bingo, right?
Bingo, because I immediately went back home and checked the maps and checked photographs, and I plucked courage to write to various professors. And I got a reply from Professor Edwards, the late Professor Edwards, who was curator at the British Museum, who was very intrigued by this suggestion and let me know that there was, in fact, something else that I should have taken into account. There was a shaft inside the Great Pyramid that actually pointed to these stars of Orion's belt. So to me, the whole thing clinched. And one thing led to another, and like we were saying earlier, I eventually published this in an article in 89, and then it went in a book form in 94. And it's been the subject of, I've lost count of several documentaries since. So there you are. That's the background.
Super. Let's go over to Dr. Thomas Brophy for a moment. Doctor, as a specialty, your early specialty was being a planetary astrophysicist. But you're not doing that anymore, are you?
No, I've moved back now.
Why? Why'd you change?
Well, as I mentioned, actually, my interest, research interest, academic interest, shifted focus from pure physical science to include what I call integral philosophy or integral theory. And the reason, though, is a sort of continuity in the sense that the reason I originally went into physics was because of wanting to
wanting to know, learn about how things work is the way to put it. And after you get through a physics program, you get a lot out of it, and it's a fantastic training in critical thinking. But even fundamental physics, we now know, especially in modern physics, describes only a part of the universe. So my fundamental interest to know how things work as a whole, totally, you do have to include physics as fundamental physics as one aspect of that, but then integral philosophy or an inclusive philosophy for the other aspects that aren't covered by physics.
Huh? These ancients obviously had an astounding ability with astronomy. How'd they know this stuff?
That's a fantastic question. That's a great question. And there's sort of two approaches to addressing that question. One is it's still controversial as to how much they really knew, especially when we're looking at these very ancient sites. They're prehistoric before writing. So to try to actually prove a sophisticated amount of knowledge is difficult, even if it seems clear sometimes from the monuments themselves. And then the other track is that as Robert and I experienced in our expedition to the deep desert, while we're investigating these things, when you're out there, when you're living in the elements, especially that region, you're just confronted with the sky, the night sky, so obviously, and it's clearly going to be an enormous part of the lives and cultures of the people of those times. So
it pops right out, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and so it's in a sense natural that they were keenly interested in developing models, you know, ideas, concepts about the universe that they were observing. And then it's clearly going to be used for the everyday lives.
All right, and Robert, you know, when you were putting this work together with Thomas, and we'll get into the Black Genesis because that's an interesting part of all these theories. When you looked at these cultures that were out there, how old do you think they are? You know, we've heard the pyramids are 5,000 years old, 10,000 years old. What do you think?
Very good question, George. Black Genesis is going to shake the apple tree, as one says. The reason being is that when I wrote The Message of the Sphinx with Graham Hancock, we used two hard sciences. There were two schools of thought going on in parallel. There was the work of Robert Schock and John West, which argued that the Sphinx, the Great Sphinx of Giza, was a much, much older monument than previously believed by the Egyptologists on the basis of geology. They made a very cogent argument based on the erosion on the Sphinx and on the enclosure wall of the Sphinx, that it was done by precipitated rainwater, which did not occur in that part of the world before the breaking, or rather after the breaking of the Ice Age. And so there was one hard science coming up with a much older date for the Sphinx. And Graham Hancock and I came with the astronomical argument.
Let's get into that, Robert, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And we're with Robert Bavall. Robert, you're talking about the age of the pyramids, the age of the Sphinx, and then when the break goddess. So let's get back into that. There's been talk that it could be 5,000 or 10,000 years old. And you're right. The Sphinx does show some water erosion, doesn't it?
It does show a lot of water erosion. Let me go through this carefully, because I think it's important for the listeners to to understand the battle that's been going on for the last 10 years or so, the so-called battle of the age of the Sphinx. It all started with John West, John Anthony West, the American author, who had read a book by Schwaller de Lubitz, where Lubitz mentioned that the erosion that was visible on the enclosure wall of the Sphinx. Now, I think it needs to be made clear. The Sphinx is not actually a built monument. It's actually carved in the living rock.
Which was, you know, the whatever it was, this huge edifice of stone was there, and they shaped it, right?
Yes. Well, let's describe the scene sometime in the distant past. There was an outcrop of rock, which today is the head of the Sphinx. And they dug around that outcrop and exposed a much larger piece of natural rock, which they fashioned in the body of a lion. So the Sphinx, in a sense, is inside a pit or an enclosure. It's a kind of shoe-shaped pit. Mm-hmm. And it is on the wall of this enclosure that are very visible horizontal erosions and vertical erosions. Now, Schwaller de Lubitz was mentioning the horizontal erosion and kind of suggested that it might have been the Nile water that perhaps reached during the flood time. I'll be talking about the flood time in a short while. And that water eroded the sides of the wall, and therefore it might have been much older, because the flood waters did not reach in known history, but might have reached in prehistory. What John West did was to take on this suggestion and sort of went trooping around the various universities. He was sort of poo-pooed and shooed away several times, but as fate would have it, he stumbled on Robert Schock, Dr. Robert Schock of Boston University, a geologist, who took an interest and actually went to Egypt. And what Schock immediately realized, being a geologist, was that it wasn't so much the horizontal erosions that were important, because these were obviously made by wind. Water does not do horizontal erosions, certainly not of the kind we saw on the wall. But what he noticed, that there were very prominent vertical fissures that clearly were made by water flowing down the enclosure walls. And to cut a long story short, through his geological analysis, he concluded that whatever the age of the Sphinx was, it was not 2,500 BC, as the Egyptologist maintained, simply because the erosion that was analyzed by him could required a much, much longer period to manage these deep cuts that he investigated. And of course, it fitted the climatic models that we now know, which gave a kind of rough range for the age of the Sphinx from 5 to 6,000 BC. So that was a few millennia earlier than the established dates. Later on, Graham Hancock and I came on the scene, and I had proposed in my first book that the layout of the three pyramids were not just mimicking the layout of Orion's belt, but they did so at a very, very unusual time. The reasoning behind this was that the ancient Egyptians spoke of a beginning. They have a term for it. They call it Tepzepi. It literally means the first time. And they believed that the god Osiris, who was identified to the constellation of Orion, had come in this period of the first time and established civilization. So the reasoning was, well, could we use the stars to establish this first time? And, of course, this brought us to the phenomena of the precession of the equinoxes. The precession of the equinoxes, very simply, is that the Earth, we know that the Earth wobbles in a very, very slow cycle of 26,000 years, and this causes the stars to appear at different heights, at different altitudes, and at different angles through that cycle of 26,000 years.
Okay.
Now, the cycle has a beginning and an end, because if one measures it at the at a certain point, which is the south meridian, or if one measures the Orion belts, it will appear to slide up and down like a pendulum moving vertically over a period of 13,000 years downwards and 13,000 years upwards. We looked at the beginning, or the lowest point, and that was the perfect fit, the kind of Cinderella fit of archaeology. The layout of the pyramids fitted precisely with the pattern of the sky. Now, here is the weird thing. When this occurred, the sunrise would be exactly at the vernal equinox, at the spring equinox, in direct alignment with the Sphinx. That was already a startling discovery, but as we looked at the stars that were behind the sun, one can do that with the computers these days,
sure.
We realized that the constellation that was right behind the sun was the constellation of Leo.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to us, clinched it. We had a kind of model of the sky that fitted, like I said, like a Cinderella shoe, at precisely 10,500 BC. And that brought in the science of astronomy in conjunction with the science of geology to confront the Egyptologists with these two hard sciences. And they've been debating ever since.
Why is it so controversial, Robert? I mean, why can't they say, well, maybe it is much older? So, you know, why do they get so upset?
Your guess is as good as mine, George. I mean, well, okay. The fact is that they... You know, Egyptology has been going on for the last 150 years or so. And we have established, or rather Egyptologists have established a chronology for Egypt. And, you know, this theory is, if indeed they're correct, would totally change the whole established view. We will have to push the Egyptian civilization several thousand years backwards, and they're not going to do it.
No, Zahi's not going to do that. That's for sure. Huh?
Yeah, well, Zahi will have. You know, many things were obstructed by the orthodoxy throughout history, and you know, it's in many ways it's understandable. I mean, they're not going to sort of change every textbook simply because there's a new theory. But if the theory sustains itself and undergoes the rigorous criticism that it's been going through, like I said, over the last 10 years, then, you know, the orthodoxy has to change. And we're kind of reaching that point, as you will see with Black Genesis.
Absolutely, and so many things to cover with you tonight. Why is it that it appears that this controversy of the pyramids is so widespread, yet at the same time, whenever we hear the word of the pyramids and the Sphinx, it just captivates us, Robert. Why is that?
I remember something that the late Professor Edwards, the ex-curator of the British Museum, said to me once in private. I can say that now because he's passed away, but I think he wouldn't have minded. He said to me, there's something very strange, Robert. I've been studying the pyramids for 70 years, and I believe there's a little pyramid in everybody's brain. Of course, he said it metaphorically, but it's true. Anything that is discovered related to the Great Pyramid or the Sphinx grabs the imagination of the public. It's one of those monuments of the past that looms literally as a giant question mark. It's just simply the personification of mystery. You know, when one looks at the Great Pyramid, and believe me, I've looked at this monument for many, many years. I remember the last interview we did, George, was in a couple of years ago, wasn't
it? Yeah, 2008, I think.
2008, that's right. Well, at the time, I was living in Egypt, if you recall, and I had an apartment literally across the Great Pyramid. I would go out on my balcony, and there it was. I could almost touch it. And it's one of those structures that no matter how many times you see it, no many times you ponder on it, it's just baffling. It's as if it shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
It's one of those things that, and of course it stirs the imagination, and there isn't one human being I know who doesn't know about the Great Pyramid, who's never heard about the Great Pyramid. I mean, there are many monuments around the world that sometimes you think, you know, I've never heard of them, you know. But the Great Pyramid is a universal icon. And that explains why every time there is something, and there is, by the way, lots of things going on. There is an announcement that was made lately. You should ask me this later on, that they're going to try and open these famous little doors again.
Oh, they got a little robot again, right? They're working on a robot?
Yes. As you know, this in 93, a German engineer, Rudolf Gantenbrink, explored the so-called shafts in the Great Pyramid. And in one of the shafts, the southern shaft going from the Queen's Chamber, he discovered a little trapdoor some 55 meters from the chamber. It created a huge sensation. I was involved with Rudolf at the time.
Right.
There you are. You were asking why it has this effect. I remember when it was announced in the newspapers, it literally was syndicated around the world. I mean, like, every single newspaper had it on the headlines.
Yeah.
It was a huge, huge reaction. Well, there was another attempt to open these doors by Dr. Hawass in 2002, and nothing came out of it because they found when they drilled a little hole through the Gantenbrink door, as
yeah.
you call it now.
This is like a little peek hole, wasn't it?
Yeah, they had a kind of peekaboo.
Yeah, exactly.
And they saw, to their surprise, about a meter away, another door.
Another door behind it, yeah.
Another door behind it. And they explored the northern shaft, the shaft on the other side, and they found a similar door resembling the Gantenbrink door. So the hopes are very, very high now of a major find. And we've been waiting and waiting for Dr. Hawass to finally decide to open these doors. You may have heard or seen a documentary series by History Channel lately
mm-hmm.
called Chasing Mummies.
Yes.
Right. Well, in before the documentary, he was interviewed on ABC, I think, News, and he announced that before the end of the year, they're going to attempt again to open these doors. There is a team that is being led by Leeds University from England. It's an internationally mounted team. They're actually there at the moment with a new robotic machine. And they've said roughly before the end of the year, so let's hope they do it.
How big are the shafts, Robert?
let me explain the structure. The pyramid has three chambers. There is a so-called subterranean chamber under the pyramid. And then there are two chambers within the structure of the pyramid. One known as the Queen's Chamber or the Lower Chamber, and one known as the King's Chamber or the Upper Chamber. Now, from these two chambers emanate these shafts, two going north and two going south. Their opening is about 20 centimeters by 20 centimeters, 8 inches by 8 inches approximately.
Oh, geez, small.
Square openings. So obviously they couldn't have been used for people to go through them.
Unless they were little people.
Very little people.
Yeah.
However, they rise at an incline, and it's been known since the 1960s. I've been part of the investigation in the 80s, that they are directed to star systems that were important for the ancient Egyptians. The ones in the south point to Orion's belt, like we said earlier. And one points to the star Sirius. And the northern ones point to the circumpolar stars, where you find the Big Dipper and the Small Dipper and the Drago constellation. Now, these were very, very important systems of stars that were part of the resurrection rituals of the pyramid builders. So the conclusion was that they were kind of symbolic paths or launching pads, if you like, to direct the soul of the king towards these star systems. The ones in the king's chamber actually shoot out of the pyramid. They actually go through the structure. The ones in the queen's chamber do not. And the mystery of these shafts in the queen's chamber is not only that they are blocked on the far end by these little doors. They were actually blocked at the entrance of the chamber. You couldn't actually see them. So it's a whole mystery. I mean, I can tell you, I've been discussing these shafts over the last 20 years with just about every expert you can imagine.
I wonder how thick do you think those doors might be? Be the door behind the door.
How thick?
Yeah.
They're about, well, if we judge from the first door, the Gantenbrick door, they're about 2.5-3 inches thick. They look like sliding doors. They seem to have been placed so that they were open at one stage and they were slid down like portcullis, like doors of a fortress, if you see what I mean.
Right.
And the idea of Gantenbrick, at least at the time, was to insert a plate, a very thin plate, under the gap of the door at the bottom, and try and lift the doors up again, rather than drill through them. But this hasn't been done. I'm not quite sure what the new team is going to do, but I have a feeling that they will probably drill again and pass a fiber optic camera and have a look and see what's on the other side.
And light it up. Now, the doors are made with what? What are they made from?
They're made, well, the whole structure of the pyramid is made of sandstone, or rather limestone. Much harder sandstone.
Yeah.
These doors are made of Chura limestone, which is very interesting because Chura limestone is not locally found at Giza. The whole rough structure of the pyramid is made of the local limestone. When they build something that is of higher or more sacred meaning, such as a sarcophagus or a chamber, they use Chura limestone. Now, Chura limestone comes from the hills that are on the other side of the Nile in Cairo, known as the Mokattam Hills. The quarries are still there, by the way. I visited them not long ago. It's quite amazing. You can actually see the quarries of the pyramid builders.
I was going to say, you could see where things were cut out and dug out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they still use them. It's quite amazing. I mean, Egyptians are still quarrying at their ancient quarries. But anyway, that's what the doors are made of. They're made of Chura limestone, which implies a very sacred location. So,
that's a good point.
You know, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, it might be the greatest find ever, or as Gantenbrick was so fearful, nothing.
Well, you know? If for some reason they find something with this fiber optic camera that they stick through a hole, how are they going to ever go in there and get all that? Let's say they have tombs in there and sarcophaguses and artifacts. How are they going to go in there and get them?
Well, considering that it's taken nearly 15 years to just have a look what's behind, I think we can count on quite a few years before they start moving this stuff. But let me say that the only way to do this, short of dismantling the pyramid, would be to enter from the outside. That would require quite a lot of work. The doors are approximately 20 meters or so from the face of the pyramid.
Robert, we're going to take this break. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back and talk more about that. I want to talk about the Hall of Records, your take on Mars and the tie-in with the pyramids, and also your latest work, Black Genesis. We'll be back. And we're with Robert Bovall here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, so you're saying that if we got into this chamber, whatever's behind there, you'd have to do it from the outside. And I guess would they have to dismantle part of the structure of the pyramids?
It's the only way to do it. Like I was saying, the doors that are we know now are on the south and north face of the pyramid, or north internal structure of the pyramid, are approximately 20 meters from the outside of the pyramid. To reach from the outside. One would have to, well, hopefully not blast. It's terrible to say this, but in fact, there was an attempt to enter these shafts in the 1830s, where Colonel Howard Vyse, a British eccentric, was allowed to explore the pyramid with dynamite, believe it or not, and blasted or attempted to blast his way in. He managed to remove two layers of blocks. It was still a long way from the doors. He had no idea.
He's lucky, lucky the whole thing didn't cave in on him.
Yeah. You can still see the horrible gashes that he made. An interesting aside is that when they did blow up these couple of courses, they found embedded in one of the courses, in one of the joints, a piece of metal which turned out to be iron. I've actually seen this piece in the British Museum, which kind of created a huge controversy. Some claim that it was not contemporary with the monument, that it probably was a spade or bits of a spade that was left by explorers.
I see, yeah.
But Howard Vyse was rather adamant that, in fact, he had blown open, and there's no way that anybody could have gone there until he exposed the joint. So if it is contemporary with the monument, this leads us to push the Iron Age much, much further back. Anyway, this strange metal plate that he found, curiously, had the side dimensions of the doors. So it could have been part of the contraption. It could have been part of the mechanism of the door. The way to reach them now would be to very, very carefully, rather than use explosives, dismantle blocks slowly, slowly. But it would be a bit like trying to enter the Empire State Building from one of its walls. It's quite a job.
Not easy. Not easy at all. And those are big blocks.
And they're very big blocks, and they're positioned in such a way that the removal would require a much larger hole. I would dread to think how it would be done. The other way, of course, would be to have very high-tech equipment to extract at least the smaller artifacts through the shaft. Now, that would be possible.
Robert, a few years ago, you had an opportunity to talk with Graham Hancock on the program about the Hall of Records that Edgar Cayce predicted would be by the base of the Sphinx. Has anything changed with that?
Yes, I recall it was in 96. Actually, on that program was also Richard Hoagland, whom I understand you just had on.
We
on
just
the
had
air.
Him on. Exactly. And he's listening to you now, by the way.
How's that old wolf?
Yeah, there he is. He's probably waiting. He's waiting until we get to the Mars theory. He can't wait for that.
Well, to answer your question in the shortest possible way, nothing unfortunately happened. We were talking, if I recall, in 96. I happened to be in Delaware University, and we went on the air with Art Bell at the time. There was Graham Hancock and me on one side, and then various guests, one of which was Hoagland. We, at the time, had been involved directly and indirectly with an expedition that was organized to actually look for this Hall of Records. It was put up by the Shore Foundation, by two members of the Edgar Cayce Foundation, Joe Jehoda and Joe Shore. And they had put up the funds. They were operating under the umbrella of the Shore Foundation, and they had been given permission to investigate with radar around the Sphinx. John West and Robert Chalk had already investigated using seismographic equipment and had, I believe, that they had detected the chamber somewhere under the poles, the front poles of the Sphinx. The radar seemed to have confirmed this. I never saw the results. They were never published, but I did talk to Joe Shore, and I think Hoagland will collaborate on this. And they confirmed that they had also detected a chamber, and possibly another larger chamber at behind, under the rump of the Sphinx. And that's it. I mean, since then, there's been several attempts to convince Dr. Hawass to probe further. I understand that they've attempted to drill around the Sphinx, but drilling is not enough. That would not confirm. We need fiber optic examination. He simply is totally blocked on this on this exploration. He simply won't allow it.
No, he was on the program with me about a year ago, Robert, as Zahi was, and
he
don't want anything to do with it. Here, but my question is it possible they've already excavated, they found the Hall of Records, and they just didn't let us know about it? Could they have done that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
You know, it would be... let me find an equivalent. It would be like excavating at in Piccadilly Circus in London and not be noticed. I mean, the Sphinx is a very, very exposed monument. There's buildings right in front of it. There's thousands, literally thousands of visitors every day. It just wouldn't be possible. But whether there's been some more radar exploration, I'm not quite sure. I'm not there all the time, and therefore I can't confirm. But it would be very, very unlikely that anything like this happens. I wish it hasn't. One of the reasons, in fact, that we had done this program in 96 was to literally blow the whistle, because the expedition was working rather covertly, and we blew the whistle so that the whole thing was exposed in the newspapers, and if anything was found, it would be announced.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that, you know, what I'm not so pleased with the announcement about the opening of the doors this year was that Zahi Hawass has stated that it will be done without any media involved.
Oh.
I don't like this, because...
I don't either, no.
Well, you know, there is many...
well, the last time he did it with a lot of media, didn't he?
Yeah. Couldn't have been more media than that. I mean,
well, if I remember, they did it live.
Yes, they did it live with National Geographic.
I remember that.
It was very much hyped before. I mean, it was really, really advertised very heavily. I understand that they had something like 600 million viewers. So, you know, it was really a very big media event. The whole thing was rather bizarre and I think badly planned, and it kind of ended up pear-shaped, because what everybody was waiting, of course, was what would they do once they attempt to open the doors and have a look behind. But the show ended with this kind of very quick wrapping up of showing us through the little hole that they had drilled. We saw the second door, and that was it. I must say that what has baffled many researchers, including myself, since then, was that other than what National Geographic has put on their website, merely showing some photographs of the work they did, no publication has been issued by the Antiquity Department or any other Egyptologist. I mean, we have no idea, for example, as to the scientific finds that they made. For example, they removed a copper handle from the Gantenbrick door. And when they explored the northern shaft, they must have removed a piece of wood that had been found there by Gantenbrick. We actually saw it with the video cameras. What's happened to these artifacts, we have no idea. And that, to me, is a very bizarre thing, because usually these things get published very quickly and put in the arena for other investigators to look at. But to me, the whole thing is very baffling.
Absolutely. Now, what do you think of Edgar Cayce? Because I'm gonna ask you about his Atlantis connection with the pyramids. But what are your views on him?
I've never met him.
No.
I did meet his grandson, Thomas. And I I've studied Casey, like many researchers of the pyramid did. I mean, even Mark Lehner, who is one of the world experts today on the Giza Necropolis. There is even rumors that Zahi Hawass was involved with them for quite a while. He seemed to have been a very honest man. I was dragged into the Casey activity, not because I was involved with the foundation, but simply because the date that I derived from the astronomy, you remember I was explaining how we worked out the first time date.
Right.
And that date came to 10,500 BC, purely from an astronomical analysis. What was stunning is that this was the exact date that Casey said that the Atlanteans, whoever he claimed had come to Egypt, had come at that date and built the Hall of Records. So to me, that was one hell of a coincidence. I was really taken by this. And of course, the Casey people were rather astounded that here was a kind of scientific argument that buttressed the intuitive conclusions that Casey had arrived at. So, who knows? Maybe he was on the right track.
Yeah, maybe so. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the Mars mystery, then we'll get into Black Genesis.
Sure.
Right after the break, Robert. You and Graham Hancock wrote the book, The Mars Mystery, and you talked a little bit about a connection between the Giza site and the monuments of Sidonia. This is where Richard C. Hoagland's ears perk up. Tell me about that.
Well, it started with, for me at least, it started with the discovery of the Mars meteorites that were found in 97, if I recall, or late 96, where there was quite a big fuss because it was believed that they contained microorganisms that might prove the existence of or past existence of life on Mars. Immediately, I contacted Graham Hancock and said, well, this is bizarre because I've heard about these so-called monuments of Mars. I had read Hoagland's publications and various others. And one thing led to another, and we decided to write the Mars mystery. We met Hoagland, we met various other researchers, Mark Carlotto at the time, and other researchers in England. And, you know, we approached the problem purely from what I call a Platonic argument, without preconceived ideas, saying, well, here's a planet next to us. It's a dead planet for all appearance. But here is the possibility that it might have had life. And here is the possibility that there are structures, at least from judging from the photographs that were taken by the Voyager, is that right, Hoagland? You know, they did look like pyramids, and this very bizarre kind of face that invited a correlation with the Sphinx. So the conclusion that we took is, let's have a look at this. I mean, my take on this was that even if there is a millionth of a chance that these structures are artificial on Mars, then it's our duty to explore them, to find out. I mean, future generations will consider us extremely biased if we simply ignore that possibility. And therefore, we took the challenge and we investigated. I'm still very unsure about the conclusions. I must say that I'm not convinced either way. But, you know, things have changed. By the way, you were talking earlier on, if I'm not mistaken, about planets having been discovered lately.
More and more.
More and more, yes. I think the count is 400 plus now. The so-called exoplanets, planets that are outside our solar system. And in a very, very small area of our galaxy. I want to go into that, by the way, later on, because the whole picture has changed as to what might be out there. I was very intrigued by the National Geographic magazine a couple of months ago with the front page title, Are We Alone? I mean, it was kind of very bold for the National Geographic to come up with this question. But it's become kind of okay now to really consider the possibility of extraterrestrial life. And the whole picture changes. The reason being is that the very small patch of galactic zone that we explored within the arm of the Orion belt, if you like, mm-hmm. if I understand well, it's a bit like looking at Central Park in relation to the whole surface of the Earth. I mean, it's a very, very small patch of our galaxy. And already we found something like 400 planets plus. So the conclusion is that there must be millions, if not billions, of planets just within our own galactic system. And there are thousands of these galaxies about, millions or billions of these galaxies. I mean, the number is staggering. So to now not consider the possibility of life outside our solar system and intelligent life is, in fact, you know, the pinnacle of arrogance. I mean, we must be open to that possibility. And if we are, then we must be open to their interference, perhaps on this planet.
In assuming the Orion theory is correct, that that's how they were built, they were aligned that way, might they have come from that area in the spatial skies?
Well, let me answer the question in the way that I'd like to answer this question. I remember when Carl Sagan coined that very, very touching phrase. He said, we are all star stuff. And that's a fact.
And that's true. That's right.
We are made from star material. We literally come from the stars. So there's nothing unscientific in claiming that we come from the stars. The question is, which star? Our solar system is made up from material of some star that exploded in some distant past, certainly before 4 billion years ago, and formed our system. So, you know, for all we know, we do come from a Orion region, and we may be part of that star. So maybe there's a kind of recollection.
That's fascinating. Robert, let's talk a little bit more about that, then we'll get into Black Genesis as well when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. So, Robert, are you tipping toward the possibility of extraterrestrial presence and involvement with the pyramids?
I knew you were going to ask me this, George.
Yes, here you go.
Well, we both appeared on the Ancient Alien series.
Yeah. So, let me ask you, by the way, are you on a speakerphone? Come back to your other phone.
Is that okay?
That's perfect. There you go.
Sorry, I pressed the wrong button here.
That's all right.
Well, as I was saying, we both appeared on Ancient Alien series, which I thought was rather good. And you probably heard all these statements I made.
Oh, yeah.
My take, like I was saying earlier, is that we really need to keep an open mind because, excuse me, something in my throat. I was having a pancake earlier on.
You know, that's one of the reasons why I try never to eat before airtime.
Well, it's breakfast time here.
I made a mistake years ago when I was doing a little local show of eating some peanuts before airtime, Robert.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm telling you, the little salt and stuff, I mean, it just shut me down. So now I stay away from it.
Okay, no peanuts.
No peanuts. or pancakes.
Yeah. Okay, anyway, the point I'm making, really, is that the whole landscape of science has changed. You know, but as you probably know, about 40 years ago, anybody who kind of even mentioned the possibility of extraterrestrial visitation on this planet was immediately ostracized, and you were called all sorts of things. I, of course, remember when Erich von Däniken came out with his Chariot of the Gods. You know, it created quite a stir, but he's an old friend of mine, by the way. And he's received a lot of stick from all sorts of quarters. I mean, even the Vatican fell on his head. So having said this, it's now completely changed because it's quite the reverse, really. We are faced with cosmological facts and astrophysical facts that suggest quite the opposite, that our galactic system is literally teeming with planets.
Yeah.
And therefore, the possibility is extremely high. I mean, we've already started our space exploration in the last 40 years or so. I mean, we've been to the moon. We're shortly on our way to Mars. And there's absolutely no reason why other intelligent systems outside there haven't done the same and in a much more advanced way. So I'm really open to the idea. Having said this, you know, I think there's been a lot of over-exaggerations. One must look at the anomalies. I'm very much an anomaly sort of person. If something doesn't look right, a bit like my little offset of the third pyramid, then you pursue it, no matter where it takes you. We do have a couple of anomalies at Giza that are not explicable in standard terms, which leaves the door open to all sorts of possibilities. And let me just name a few. Not so much in the pyramids, but the pyramids are not just standing on their own there. There are various structures that are linked to the pyramids. The most important are the so-called valley temples and mortuary temples, which are tied on the east side of the pyramid.
Okay.
Now, it doesn't take a geologist to quickly realize that two things are very, very different when you look at these temples. One is that the erosion on them is much, much more pronounced than on the pyramids. They look far, far older, very hoary with age. I mean, it's very visible. The other thing is that they're built with blocks that are enormous. Some of the blocks, on average, are 100 tons, and there are a few. Yeah, there are a few blocks that are 200 tons. Now, let me give you a sense of scale here. You know, a 200-ton block is like taking literally 200 family cars and squishing them together, and that's what you got. You know, apart from its size, its sheer weight is beyond understanding of how a supposedly primitive people who didn't have the wheel, who didn't have iron, who didn't have the pulley, as a matter of fact, who had nothing other than brutal force and some strings and a bit of wood, would have moved these structures, these blocks, dozens and dozens of them, to build temples.
And to lift them up. I mean, it's moving it or pushing it is one thing. That could take a zillion years. But then you have to get these things up. It doesn't make
absolutely
any sense.
And of course, the big question is why? I mean, why? Because you definitely do not need blocks of this size to build a temple. You know, I mean, they've proved it at the pyramids. The pyramids
good
have
point.
Blocks that are approximately, on average, 2 to 3 tons. I mean, these are already big, but nowhere near the 100 tons that we see at the temples. And so there's no reason at all to use these kind of large blocks. And to me, that's the nearest thing to "quote unquote alien." It's alien thinking. As an engineer, I wouldn't think in those terms. I would definitely not try and build a temple with 200-ton blocks.
You would build it the way you could move it and lift it and push things around.
Exactly.
That's how you design it. So you're right.
So absolutely. I mean, the evidence that we have around the Giza Necropolis shows us that they would use blocks of 2 tons, sometimes 3 tons. They're easier to maneuver, of course, strong enough to take the weight certainly of a temple, They've taken the weight of the pyramid. So there is absolutely no reason. The conclusion that I've arrived, and I think Robert Schock has arrived at this conclusion, other than looking at a paranormal explanation, is that they're very, very old. They belong to a different phase. We're beginning to call it the megalithic phase, a phase that occurred before the pyramid builders and probably at the time of the Sphinx. This is very interesting because I want to come to Black Genesis as soon as possible,
yeah,
because this is what we're finding. We're actually finding a megalithic prehistoric culture that was at the doorstep of pharaonic Egypt, which we hadn't detected until 30 years ago.
Perfect transition for this. Go ahead.
Hello? Yes?
Yeah. Perfect transition for Black Genesis.
I'd like to repeat that this project is between myself and Thomas Brophy, Dr. Mm-hmm. Thomas Brophy. The reason is that he's brought in his physics and astrophysics expertise to look at these strange structures that we've been finding in the Sahara. Now, let me give you a picture. I think it's important to visualize the scenery here.
Okay.
Now, Egypt is a large square. It's about 1,000 kilometers long, going north-south, and it's approximately 1,000 kilometers wide. It would have been a total desert if it wasn't for the Nile that splits literally this country in half. And apart from the green, fertile valley, a sort of thin green belt that runs along the Nile from north to south, the rest of the country is pure desert.
You think it's always been that way?
Well, no, I'm getting there.
Okay.
Now, on the west side is the Eastern Sahara. I'd rather call it the Egyptian Sahara. It's a huge rectangular swathe of land that is only inhabited today by pockets of oases. There are five major oases that kind of run parallel to the Nile. They're approximately about 200 kilometers or so away from the Nile, and they kind of run parallel all the way to the south. Now, the rest is just desert. Now, this is important to realize that other than the oases, all the region of the Egyptian Sahara is not only desert, but most of it has not been explored. It's one of those last corners of exploration.
Right. Very treacherous, isn't it?
Absolutely. I did an expedition with Tom Brophy in 2008, and I'll tell you about it in a minute because it's quite a story. Now, here's the weird thing, is the extreme southwest of Egypt, of this Egyptian Sahara, which literally juts into Libya and Sudan. It's a corner. You could literally stand in that corner and have 2 feet, one in Libya, one in Sudan, and have your arms in Egypt. It's literally where the three countries meet.
Okay.
Now, this corner, this faraway corner, was not explored until the 1920s, as amazing as it may sound. The reason being is that it's theoretically impossible to travel there without motorized facilities, either with four-wheel drives or with aeroplanes. It's just too far. You cannot go with animals of burden like the ancients had, because there is no water from the last oasis, an oasis called Dakhla. There is 700 kilometers of what Brophy correctly called the deep desert or the open desert, with not any trace of water on the way. So there's no way that you can carry that water using animals of burden. It's theoretically impossible.
Right. Even the biggest camel with the biggest hump could not make that trip.
Yeah, it's a bit like trying to cross the United States with your motorbike without filling the tank.
Exactly.
It just can't be done.
Can't be.
You need refueling stations. Now, I'll get to that because we now know that they actually did travel, the ancients did travel to those remote areas, but I'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
So, until the 1920s, it was believed that nobody had gone there. the Egyptologists were utterly convinced that the ancient Egyptians did not travel beyond the oasis. That was it. There's many, many evidence of their presence at the oasis. We find tombs and temples, but beyond that, zilch. It's just bare. Now, in 1923, a very flamboyant and colorful explorer called Ahmed Hassanein Bey, an Egyptian, a rather amazing character. You'll read about it in Black Genesis. We devoted almost a chapter to him because he was quite a character. He was educated in England at Oxford. He was, among many things, a fencing champion of the Olympics, absolutely highly qualified in politics. He went to Balliol College in Cambridge.
He was like the Omar Sharif of his time.
Oh, more than Omar Sharif. And he was a one hell of a womanizer, apparently. Very, very attractive man who apparently seduced one of the queens of Egypt. Anyway.
That's not very smart. Not if the king was still around, right? Or the pharaoh, or
no, when the king died, actually. he was actually the tutor of King Farouk, the last king of Egypt.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yes, he became a kind of adoptive father. A very, very interesting man. Anyway, his passion was not just women. He just loved the desert. And he was utterly fascinated by the exploits of Lawrence of Arabia in the 1917s when Lawrence of Arabia crossed the Negev Desert. And he knew that the only place that was unexplored was this extreme southwest of Egypt. And he mounted, of all things, a caravan of camels. He was considered utterly mad to try it. But he actually made it. He cleverly went from the Mediterranean on the Libyan side and went to an oasis called Kufra, where he replenished with water and took the risk to carry on, not knowing that he would find water later on, further and hit this south corner. Now, let me tell you, he discovered a mountain range, which is about 30 kilometers wide and 30 kilometers deep. It's called Jebel Uwainat. You'll hear a lot about this in Black Genesis. It's one of the most mysterious places on this planet. He discovered it, and nobody knew it was there. And luckily for him, there was a few water pools, not wells. The water apparently accumulated when it rarely, very rarely rains, and accumulated in the mountain heights, and would trickle down and form these little pools. So he was able to replenish. But here's the weird thing: they were thought that the place was totally uninhabited, and while he was camping there with his guides, one morning he was utterly shocked because he woke up and there was this very beautiful Black woman standing in front of him with a bowl of milk.
Where'd she come from?
Well, they managed to understand her. She spoke a language called Tebu, which is the ancient language of the Sahara dwellers. And luckily, he had a Tebu guide with him. And this guide talked to this girl, and she, young girl, apparently, she was in her teens. Very beautiful. There are pictures of her, which we have put in Black Genesis, by the way.
Yeah.
They had an old-fashioned camera, and they managed to take pictures. And she said, "I want to invite you to meet my king, the king of this mountain area." So they went, and there were 150 of these Black people that claimed to have been living there since time immemorial. There was a king called Heni. And the king said, "Well, we've been here a long, long time. Let me show you what my ancestors left behind." And he took them to see these rock carvings and rock drawings, which absolutely stunned the world. When Hassanein reported this to the Royal Geographical Society in London, they were taken aback because here there was, in this remote region where it was thought to be uninhabited, not only people still living there, but people who claim to have come from this remote region. And now the rock art that was seen there contained drawings of animals that could not possibly have existed there unless the place was fertile. There was drawings of giraffes and lions and hippopotamus and ostriches and crocodiles.
Interesting.
So clearly that place must have been very fertile. All this fauna doesn't exist today except further 1,000 kilometers in Central Africa.
Or what if these people somehow migrated there thousands of years ago and maybe, you know, came from the central heart of Africa, for example?
Well, you're second-guessing me a bit.
Sorry, Robert.
Fine. You're on the right track here. Well, what came out of all this? In fact, what is known now is that the Sahara was indeed fertile in prehistoric times. The reason is that after the breaking of the last ice age, approximately 10, 11,000 years BC, the rains that were caused by this huge breakdown of the ice in the area created giant monsoons, which still occur, by the way, in Central Africa, but not as big as they were then. And the monsoons were able to reach that extreme southern part of Egypt. They don't these days, but there was big the downpours of rain around the 8,000, 10,000 BC. And this would create lakes, temporary lakes, which were sided by beautiful pastoral areas. Now, we know this not just from the climatic studies, but from the actual drawings that were found since then. I went to see them with Tom Brophy. We actually took an expedition to Jebel Uweinat. But let me complete the story, because this wasn't the last discovery. After Hassanein Bey made the discovery of Jebel Uweinat, what he had missed, amazingly, was an even greater mountain range that he must have grazed and not seen. He must have passed about 100 kilometers away. This area was discovered by a prince of Egypt, of all people, Prince Kamal ed-Din, who was inspired by Hassanein, and he managed to get, at the time, we're talking in 1926, the Ford company building the very first four-wheel drive.
All right, let's talk more about that when we come back. Robert Bavall, he has co-authored the book Black Genesis with Dr. Thomas Brophy, and we'll take your phone calls next hour as well. Fascinating. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Robert, let's get back into the Black Genesis before we take phone calls. So they meet this young woman. She says, come on and meet the king. And off they go, and they see these artifacts, these the things that they've done with monuments. Pick it up from there.
Yes. Well, here we are now in 1926, and I was saying earlier that a prince of Egypt, Prince Kamal ed-Din, inspired by the exploration of his predecessor, Hassanein, who discovered Jebel Uweinat, contacted the Ford company, who built for him three, if I recall well, three motorized vehicles, the very, very first vehicles, which we, I suppose, could call four-wheel vehicles. And he started his exploration, not as Hassanein did, along the Libyan border, but he went across Egypt and headed straight for the southwest corner. And on the way, about 200 kilometers before the Jebel Uweinat, that mysterious place where there was the king and that woman, he came across a mountain range that he named Gilf Kebir. Now, this is extraordinary. I mean, we're 1926, and what he discovered was a mountain range the size of Switzerland. If you can visualize Switzerland without any trees, that's how the Gilf Kebir looks like. I mean, I've seen it lately with Tom Brophy. And totally unexplored. I mean, no modern man had been there. A few years later, it was explored by the famous Count El Mashi. For those who have seen the film, The English Patient, have you seen it, George?
Oh, yes. Yep.
Well, you remember when she dies in the cave, Lady, what was her name? in that famous cave of swimmers. Well, that's where they didn't actually film there. They reconstructed the cave. In fact, they didn't film there because it's so remote, they couldn't get there. And Count El-Mashi, who actually existed, went there with a small gypsy moth plane that he had got. She was called Lady Clayton, by the way. That's right, Lady Clayton. And she didn't really die there, by the way. The Hollywood made her die in the cave, but in fact, she died getting out of the plane in England. She stumbled and broke her neck. Not very romantic. But
no.
But anyway, this region, like I said, is the size of Switzerland. Even today, hardly explored. When Count El-Mashi went there, he found the famous Cave of Swimmers, and there was the first literally drawings. What had been seen at Jebel Uweinat were actually carvings. They had carved on the rock the picture of animals. And what was at Gelf Kebir in this Cave of Swimmers were actually drawings made by artists, prehistoric artists, and they drew themselves. And here was the first literally pictures of prehistoric people, black people, with clearly a very sophisticated kind of society. They had domesticated cattle. One can see them with cattle, and they seem to have had houses. And they seem to have had a lot of fun. They're always shown dancing and performing all sorts of wonderful rituals and swimming. This cave of swimmers shows them diving in what is obviously pools of water and lakes, which, of course, do not exist there now. Now, the whole region, of course, it excited a lot of interest with anthropologists, but was forgotten. Okay, fair enough. There were people living there, prehistoric people. It was nothing very new, really, because we knew that there were other prehistoric people living in other places of the Sahara. What is new, and this is where Tom Brophy comes in, is that somewhere along the sixth or seventh millennium, these people must have moved further east towards the Nile Valley. And they settled in a place called Napta Playa. And now we come to this mysterious Napta Playa. Yeah. Now, Napta Playa was discovered only in 1974. We tell the whole story, by the way, in Black Genesis. It's quite an incredible story. A team of American anthropologists led by Fred Wendorf from the South Methodist University of Texas was driving along in that desert region about 100 kilometers west of Abu Simbel. Abu Simbel is the most southern point on the Nile, where there is the famous temple of Ramses II, these colossi that people see in movies. And they were about 100 kilometers from the Nile, and they stopped, of all things, to have what they call a comfort break. They were having a pee. And while they were standing there having their comfort break, they noticed stones that were sticking out of the ground. And as they looked closer, there was all sorts of potsherds and strange carved stones. And so they realized that they had stumbled on a prehistoric site. They named it Napta Playa. Napta is the word that anthropologists used for a dried lake or dried riverbed. Playa. And Napta is the name coming from the Arabs. It means little grains of corn or whatever. What is strange is that they started exploring this region. They started setting up a team. They called themselves the Combined Prehistoric Expedition. It was formed between the American team and the Polish Academy of Science, the Polish Academy of Science, headed by Fred Wendorf. And for a long time, they considered the site purely from an anthropological point of view. It was very mysterious. They very quickly identified it not as a settlement, but rather as a ceremonial complex. What they found, which was very bizarre and still mystifies us today, was a variety of megalithic constructions. Let me explain a bit here. Can I go on?
Yeah, absolutely.
Interrupt me when you want to.
We'll get to the calls, but I want this is fascinating. I want to hear this.
Yes. Okay, let me explain how this place looks like. I've been there many times, and Tom as well has been several times. We've been together as well. The first thing that they were taken was that they found a sort of mini Stonehenge, what they call today a calendar circle, made of not very large stones, but what was intriguing, and I'll come to that in a minute, is that they're set in a way that very clearly shows astronomical alignments. But they didn't realize this at the time. They weren't really looking for astronomical alignments. They also found what they called structural complexes. There's all sorts of cluster of stones that look like little mini prehistoric temples, very, very small clusters. And it looks like things were buried underneath these clusters. When they started excavating some of these, they opened five. There's quite a lot of them. They were expecting to find human bodies. What they were surprised to find, in some of them, they found buried cattle.
Clearly, cattle? Huh.
Yep. Very clearly ceremonial burials. The cattle were placed in such a manner that looked like they were placed complete, some artifacts around them. They were all
like,
facing.
Like they worshipped them?
Almost certainly, and this is very important because we now realize that what we thought was original to pharaonic Egypt, the cattle cults, like the cult of Isis, the cult of the sky goddess, probably came from there. But let me carry on. In some of these excavations, they were surprised to find not cattle or human bodies, but huge boulders buried, literally buried, in underneath these clusters at about 3 meters deep. And underneath these boulders, some 8 or 9 meters deep, they found the natural bedrock, outcrops of natural bedrock, which had been carved by human hands. Now, this is very weird, apart from the fact that we have no idea why they wanted to bury these boulders, which were clearly also fashioned. One of them actually looks like a, very roughly like a cow. It's absolutely mysterious. To add to this mystery, they began to suspect that some of the stones that were protruding out of the ground had been actually placed in alignments. And Fred Wendorf had a hunch. They thought maybe something to do with the aligning monuments, like they knew that had been done in ancient Egypt. And they invited an astronomer, Kim Melville from Boulder, Colorado. And he immediately realized when he went there that he was looking at a ceremonial site that had astronomical alignments. Now, the first thing that they published in Nature magazine was the stone circle. What they quickly realized was that it was actually a calendar, a solar calendar. Now, we're talking about a solar calendar that roughly was estimated because of carbon dating they managed to do to about 6 or 7,000 BC. Now, that's several thousand years before Stonehenge. And several thousand years before the pyramid builders. Here were people in the Sahara, black people, doing the very thing that we thought was not done till the time of the pyramid builders. You know, it was stunning. I mean, it created a shockwave, and that's in fact what drew Thomas Brophy into the investigation. You know, for all researchers in this field, this was a stunner. Prehistoric people going as far as 7,000, 8,000 BC. Actually having calendars, you know, and
it is remarkable. You know, it's like the Mayans almost, isn't it?
Well, long, long before the Mayans, but it's now considered the oldest astronomical site in the world. Nabta Playa is definitely the oldest. However, here comes even more interesting. From one of these major structural complexes, they named it Structural Complex A, shot out like spokes from a bicycle wheel, towards the horizon, towards the east and towards the north, alignments of stones. And when Melville worked out the alignments, he found out that they were aligned to star systems. And lo and behold, the very star systems that the pharaohs used for the pyramids.
Now, were aligned- these, these star systems you could see with the naked eye?
Well, you can see today, yes. Well, you can see them then, yes. Of course you can see them with the naked eye. I'm talking about Orion's Belt, about Sirius, and about the Big Dipper, which are the three constellations that are aimed by the shafts in the Great Pyramid. So here they were in the desert, 100 kilometers from the Nile, doing the very same thing several thousand years before the pyramid builders.
Amazing.
What is more, let me just finish this and then we'll take some questions. What is more is that they weren't just aligning to these stars. They were actually tracking their movement over several thousand years, because we can see very clearly from overhead pictures that the lines that they placed of stones very slowly were shifted as the stars shifted with precession over the centuries. This means that they weren't just doing astronomy. These people were actually tracking stars with precession. For any astronomer to realize this, we had a very sophisticated bunch of prehistoric astronomers. They're doing the thing that we didn't think was being done long, long afterwards, until the Greeks came on the scene.
Why do you think they were doing this?
Well, here is the story as we're piecing it up, and I'll come to the bit where you said they might have come from further deep in
from
Africa.
Central Africa, right.
Well, what we believe happened, and we know this from climatic studies, is that gradually the Sahara became more and more arid.
Right.
And they must have moved by that time. They were. What was happening is the monsoons would come, drench the desert in the summer season. These would form temporary lakes, and the lakes would probably be there for a few months. Now, some lakes stayed longer than others. Some were deeper and managed to dry in much slower, which forced the people of the Sahara to learn how to navigate in this vast region. And the only way you can navigate in the Sahara, like at sea, is you have to study the stars. It's very, very obvious when you are in the Sahara. When Tom Brophy and I did the expedition in April, the very first thing you notice at night is the stars. You just can't avoid them.
And if you don't navigate right in the Sahara, you probably end up dying out there, right?
If you don't know how to navigate and you don't know where to find the water, you are literally taking your life in your hands, because let me put it this way. They not only had to find the place where the water was, they had to go there at the right time. If they went before the rains, they wouldn't find the water. If they went after the lake had dried, they wouldn't find the water. They had to time it right. And in order to time it, they had to work out calendars. And they did so. It's very clear from the way that they traveled and the way that they left us this legacy of alignments, that they knew how to time. They knew how to read the sky like we do today. Now, amazingly, this is another thing, is that they still do this, by the way. We went to talk to Bedouins who still use the stars for traveling. They don't have GPSs like we do today.
But they're probably still pretty accurate, huh?
Well, you know, I'll tell you one thing. Once you're out there at night, after a few days, the sky becomes a kind of second nature. I mean, you're simply out there for hours looking at these constellations. And you begin to notice the direction of certain constellations setting at the time they rise and so forth. Very, very quickly, you begin to formulate in your mind how to navigate. It becomes second nature. I mean, we for example, at night, when we had to travel and walk away from the camp, we had to keep our lights off, by the way, because it's a very, very dangerous area. There are a lot of marauders there, and there is the war in Darfur not very far. So we didn't want to leave the lights of the camp on to draw people there. So we had to turn the lights off. Now, on moonless nights, the desert becomes sort of like pitch dark.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And if you move 100 yards or so, you lose sight of the camp. And it's very, very easy to get yourself mixed up. You know, you lose sense of direction.
The it's only like way walking with your eyes closed, isn't it?
It's like walking with your eyes closed. Now, what you naturally do instinctively is you mark the direction with the position of a star. And that becomes instinctive. I mean, you do this, and by the time we had finished our expedition, we were actually using the stars at night. So one can imagine the people living there for centuries, for millennia, and they must have been real, real stargazers, observing and learning the whole motion of the celestial activity. Now, here is what we think happened, is that when the desert became super arid, there was no way they could stay in the desert any longer. They took their domesticated cattle, they took their cargo of knowledge, all this knowledge that they acquired from stargazing, calendars, and so forth, and they moved to the Nile Valley. They moved somewhere probably around Abu Simbel or Aswan. We're finding evidence there now.
Mm-hmm.
And they injected, in a sense, their cargo of knowledge into the people that were there, if there were people at all. And 1,000 years later, we have the pyramids. So this is the amazing conclusion that is drawn. Now, where did they come from originally? And this is where we come to the point that you raised. We all know that the human race started in East Africa. I mean, this is not theory, this is fact now.
Right.
And I think for all our listeners, this is a very, very important point that although has been hammered over the last 20 years or so by anthropologists and genetic engineers and so forth, it still hasn't sunk in that we all emerge from one black African woman, which has been named the African Eve. We literally all come from her.
Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment, and we'll take the call. So if you're on hold, don't hang up. We'll get to you. Calls are lining up for you, Robert, but very quickly, give us your take on where you think they came from.
Yes. Well, what we definitely know is that some 200,000 years ago or so, a woman, which we have named Black Eve or African Eve, gave birth to the first modern man. How and why this happened, we don't know, but it happened. And from that woman, we all come from. I mean, you, me, everybody on this planet that's alive is linked and starts off with that particular moment 200,000 years ago. Now, they spread from somewhere in East Africa, and they started spreading around. Within 80,000 years or so, they had moved virtually everywhere on the planet. They had reached the Americas, they had reached the furthest points in Europe, and so forth. The planet began to get populated. However, what we now think is that one group must have gone some distance northwest towards what is the area of Chad today. There is a very mysterious mountain called the Tibesti Mountains, the Enedi Tibesti Mountains, very unexplored. The reason I'm saying that we think they come from there is that we found prehistoric art that matches exactly the rock art that we found in the southwest of Egypt, these mountainous areas I was describing. They must have stayed there for a few thousand years, if not more. We have no idea. We need to explore these areas. Tom and I are planning an expedition there. Sometime around 15 or 12,000 BC, they descended in the sub-Sahara into Egypt. And they stayed there till about 3,500 BC, and then they moved up the Nile. These people were obviously of black African origins. We know that because Tom and I have gone to see this rock art, and we actually saw some recently discovered caves, discovered by friends of ours a few years ago. And there they are. I mean, we've published these pictures, by the way, in Black Genesis. Wonderful-looking people, very obviously very sophisticated, wearing some marvelous attires, hats and bangles and bracelets, and very clearly having developed very, very early, perhaps even for the first time, rudiments of agriculture, certainly domesticated cattle. They have these wonderful paddocks that they drew, and it's really fantastic. And they physically, they look very tall, very slender, and black. They're definitely of black origins. We know for sure that they injected their race into the Nile Valley. There is still remnants of these people in Higher Nubia, And there's no doubt that when you go there, you meet the ancestors. I mean, they're there. Now, what is extraordinary is that not only we didn't know this, but we thought that the ancient Egyptians themselves had no idea of their origins. Well, here is the stunner. Two friends of ours, Mark Borda, a Maltese businessman.
All right, and give us his story, then we got to take some calls here, Robert.
Yes. In a nutshell, in 2007, Mark Borda and a fellow called Mahmoud Marai explored the Uwainat region again, and they found for the very first time, proving that the pharaohs went there, they found pharaonic inscriptions. The pharaohs went there to meet their ancestors. They actually show us drawings of the meeting. So there's these people there who still existed at the time of the pharaohs, and the pharaohs meeting them. So this is a completely different picture. Anyway, I'll take calls now.
All right, now we go. Sam is in Santa Rosa, California, and he'll be our first caller. Go ahead, Sam.
Hey, thanks, guys. Hey, Robert. Hey, George.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I follow a lot of different websites, and I listen to Project Camelot. And recently, she did an interview with Michael Tellinger on Adam's Calendar, which is in South Africa. And that's like the oldest known site. I know the Napta Playa is where we first started to study the stars. And I was also wondering, what do you think of the aquifers that were under the pyramids, giving energy to them? Do you feel that they were energy sites?
Well, I take your first question, what you started saying. I've actually met Michael Tellinger in England last month. We were at a conference together. I do know of his work and his discoveries in South Africa. There is a conference there taking place in March. I may be going, where he will be taking some of our researchers. Graham Hancock is going and a variety of other people. Yes, it's very, very interesting. I'm not quite sure about the dates, but what Michael has found, which adds to the mystery of this story, is that some of the megalithic astronomical stones that he found there actually were aligned to Orion's belt. So here we have the same evidence, the same fingerprints in another corner of Africa. It's kind of bizarre that we're finding this kind of evidence across the world. I think what's going to come out of all this is that there was sometime around the 15th millennium BCE, running perhaps till 10,000 BCE, a prehistoric culture worldwide that has left its fingerprints literally all over the place. We're beginning to see that there is a correlation between all these sites. But it's too long to explain now, but there's many studies being done, particularly by friends of mine in England, Chris Knight and Alan Butler, who are working on measurements that are found common to all these sites.
What do you think of Chris Dunn's theory that the pyramid of the pyramids at Giza are power plants?
I'm not so sure about this, but Chris is a very good friend of mine. He's just published a book, by the way, which I received yesterday. So you might want to interview him on this one. It's about ancient technologies at the time of the pharaohs. I'm very, very impressed with Chris.
Well, we just had him on.
Oh, you had Chris on?
Ah. Yeah, he was on last week.
Well, he must have talked about his latest book. It's very impressive, I must say.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's nice to hear the opinion of a expert in tool making to analyze this. I in fact, was with Chris in Egypt. I had invited him in 1995, I think it was, or 96. We were doing a documentary, Hancock and I, and we invited Chris to come and tell us about his work. It was very, very impressive. He came along with a steel rule that was calibrated to something like 0.00 point of an inch, sort of a fraction of a hair thickness. And for the first time, I actually saw with my own eyes the kind of precision work that wasn't apparent when one looks at photographs and without any of his instruments. But it's kind of stunning. This adds to the mystery. You know, we are totally baffled as to how they achieved this kind of precision carving very, very hard stone like diorite and granite. And why? I mean, the whole thing is really bizarre. I think Egyptology is bound for a big surprise.
All right. Let's go to Tom in Toledo, Ohio. There you go, Tom. You're up with us. Go ahead.
Well, I'm a first-time caller. I believe that a long time ago, I may have been partially instrumental in some of the work that you guys have done. There was a research assistant for Graham Hancock that lived in Lansing, Michigan, and one of the things that he participated in was Native ceremonies. And he interviewed me many, many times in reference to Graham's work. And, simple things like he would just call me up and bounce different things off of me and get my take on them.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me when he became a friend of his and started working with Graham back right after Fingerprints of the Gods.
Right.
But Ed, he asked me about the pyramids, and I told him that in my opinion, that they were there, that the pyramids are much older, and that they were there, and the Egyptians came upon them, found them, and believed that they were the temples of the gods, and they set up house there. He asked me about the Sphinx, and I told him, well, the Sphinx is very interesting because here you have a people who created these pyramids that are, you know, just within feet of being absolutely perfect on such a scale that they are. And here you have the Sphinx that is the perfect shape of a lion with a little bitty head carved on it, which is way out of proportion. These people were exact in their proportions. I said it was my belief that that was originally a lion, probably representing Leo. And that it was originally a lion's head, and over time, the pharaohs recarved one of their heads in its place. I told them that the pyramids themselves, I had done a lot of study when I was very, very young, read book after book on it, believed that Egyptology, back when I was a child, I'm 50 years old, but I believed back when I was a child, the books and stuff published on it were way out of line. But the native elders said that as above, so below. And I told them that I would look for messages in the stars.
Well, what's your name again?
My name is Tom. I'll just say Tom P., but I was in Sweat Lodge with Graham Hancock in Michigan and down in Hillsdale. I was one of the native elders that participated there in the ceremonies. I'm also a seer. So I look back, and this is what I see. And then in reading about some of these other people's works, a gentleman that's done all of the research, I can't think of his name at the moment, right off my top of my head, that did the research on the Anunnaki.
Zechariah Sitchin.
Yeah, I believe he's on the right track. I believe that the Bible and other documents, the Vedic texts and whatnot, refer to a time when angels were incarnate among men. And I believe that that's who built these structures, that they are basically temples of the gods, but these were done by those who wanted to set themselves up as gods themselves.
And let's get your take on this, Robert, as we have 5 minutes to go here, and we'll take a few more calls. Assuming ETs help provide the technology to build these structures, do you still think they used Egyptian labor to do it?
Well, all this is highly speculative, George, as you know.
Sure.
However, I'd like to tell Tom that he might be interesting to know that Graham is on his way to the States. He'll be touring around the States starting from, I think, the 6th of September. He's presenting his new novel, Entangled. Graham and I are writing a book, by the way, called The Master Game, which will be published soon, sometime early next year. But coming back to your question, George, well, throwing a wild view on this, I mean, you know, one of the things that is baffling about these monuments, apart from their size and their accuracy and the size of the stones they used and the lack of evidence that we have of how they did them, there's absolutely little, if anything, known. One of the baffling things is that they do not contain any inscriptions. Now, to me, this is one of the things that has mystified me and still does mystify me every time I think about it, because one thing for sure that we knew about the ancient Egyptians is that they loved to write. They loved to fill their walls with inscriptions and drawings. I mean,
and they documented, it seems, almost everything except how to build the pyramids.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's as if these monuments were totally ignored by them. I mean, it's really bizarre. You do find inscriptions, of course, in the Fifth Dynasty pyramids, which are the pyramid texts, but not at Giza. I mean, one thing that strikes you at Giza when you enter the Great Pyramid is its total bareness. I mean, you're there in a very mysterious environment with the...
Somewhere, Robert, the architectural renderings and schematics have got to be there, whether they put it on papyrus or a wall or something. The architect who came up with this precision had to have had drawings, right?
You know, my brother, you should have my brother on the radio once, because he's an architect and he is very, very interested in the pyramid. We actually go and lecture together these days. We're off to England next week. And, you know, it's very interesting to listen to an architect's viewpoint, because very often the Egyptologists who talk about this pyramid ignore the enormous amount of work that is done before you lay the first stone.
Absolutely.
You know, these projects have to be planned. These projects have to be designed.
Plus with all these little tombs and crevices. And I mean, these things were thought out. They were put together like a Rubik's Cube puzzle, weren't they?
Yes. Let me just make a point here, is that, you may know, I'm a construction engineer. I've worked in construction projects for many, many years.
Yeah.
Now, even on a minor project of building, say, a hospital or an hotel, the documentation would, in those days, I mean, now we do a lot of things on computer, but the paperwork, the documentation before the project, in order to design the project, the drawings, the specifications, the instructions, would fill a small room. Now, for the pyramids, if we were to plan the construction of a pyramid today, the pre-work, what we call the preliminaries, would be so enormous that I'm surprised that we're finding absolutely nothing, no mention
nothing
at all. And even more mysterious, like I keep saying, is that no inscriptions, nothing, zero. You know, you enter those pyramids and you're totally baffled as to why they didn't put one single inscription just to tell us who built it.
To me it sounds like it was done way before they got here.
Well, it's as if they, you know, I mean, I know my Egyptological critics will jump me on that one, but it's as if they found them there. It's as if they themselves didn't understand where these things came from.
They stumbled upon them.
Well, they were there. I mean, I don't know if they stumbled, but it certainly, that's the funny thing about this place, is that here we are in the 21st century. We've got all sorts of engineers, technicians, architects, theologians, philologists, archaeologists, you name it, who have looked at this pyramid, not counting the amateurs and researchers like Tom and so forth. And nobody can really explain these monuments.
What great mysteries. Robert, we're out of time. I want to thank you. I want you to keep in touch with us. You're welcome back anytime, my friend. Okay?
Pleasure talking to you, George.
Robert Bevall, Black Genesis, is his latest work with Dr. Thomas Brophy. And Robert's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. Definitely pick that up and have a great read. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Nappy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.